This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasoni. It's our Health and Living segment, and, you know, I can't believe it's Friday. It feels like a Monday. We've had, I think, the last 2 weeks completely disrupted everything. It felt like the weekend yesterday, and then we're back at work, and it's the weekend again.
I know.
I'm not complaining, but...
After today's show, we probably need a lie down for tomorrow. That's right.
We do. And today's show, George, we're going to be talking about something called deep brain stimulation. Sounds deep.
I think we need that for a Friday afternoon.
I know. But, you know, I thought it was, we were fortunate enough to have a consultant neurosurgeon all the way down from the UK, Dr. Ian Lowe. He's in the studio with us. Is it Lowe or Lau?
It's Lau.
Lau. Yeah. I apologize. Okay, I can never tell.
It depends. Is it Hokkien or Cantonese, you see, when you pronounce it?
And you are Hokkien. So,
right.
Yeah. Lau it is.
It is.
From Penang. Dr. Ian lives in the UK, has been practicing as part of the NHS for how many years now?
I've been a consultant since 2007.
Okay. That's
same time we actually were consulted. We were in neighbouring hospitals, you know, in an Essex, you know, the deep in the. I want to be very careful in the words I choose. You know, I cannot, the urbanizations of Essex, you know, and then the wilderness of Essex. Mine is a further down the road called Southend-on-Sea. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Ian is from Romford. Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So it's been, what, 20 years with the NHS then?
Yes.
At least.
Yeah, that's a long time. You know, that's 10 years. 2007, did you say?
Well, as a consultant. But the thing is that prior to that, we probably have to have about 10 to 12 years of training before we get
there. That's a long time, Dr. Ian. I mean, I have to ask you this question as the loyal Malaysian. When are you coming back?
As soon as they offer me a job.
Really? You mean Talent Corp, they haven't called you yet?
Okay, we'll fix something. After today's show, there'll probably be a petition for people to get you. That's right.
Yeah,
you
know. We're lucky that Dr. Ian is down for the Chinese New Year holidays. And
yeah,
so
we grabbed him here.
Yes. You know, and he wrote in, thank you very much. Otherwise, you wouldn't have known that, you know, you have a special interest in deep brain stimulation. It's sort of a solution for movement disorders. There are many types of movement disorders, Dr. Ian. You just want to go through with us what movement disorders are before we dive into deep brain stimulation.
Yes, movement disorders are a group of conditions affecting the nerves. It's a neurological condition which is characterized by either an excessive amount of movements or too little movements.
Right.
So the most common forms are Parkinson's disease, tremor, and also dystonia.
Okay, right. What is dystonia? I was reading about that. I've never heard of it before.
Well, when you move your fingers, some muscles will relax and others will start contract. But in dystonia, the muscle groups, they contract and relax at the same time. This results in abnormal postures. And the commonest, of course, is writer's cramps, which is actually a form of dystonia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right then. And of course, when you talk about deep brain stimulation, there's a lot of talk about it in relation to Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
And we have, I mean, we've got a lot of people who have been diagnosed with Parkinson's at the moment. And we do know that it progressively, it's a declining process when it comes to manage. All you can do is manage it.
That's true.
Or slow down the progression of the disease. And, you know, George, what do you think? I mean, Parkinson's is not something that's up really your alley.
No, actually, it is. I see quite a large number of Parkinson's patients, you know, as a urologist. Mm-hmm. First of all, the Parkinson's patients actually, apart from muscular disruption, they also have bladder disruption. Mm-hmm. So they get urgency, they get incontinence, and then a lot of these patients may even get acute retention of urine. And one of the worst things we can do to them actually is to operate on them, and then they might have worsening incontinence. And so that's a group of patients I see. The other group of patients I see will be patients who suffers from sexual dysfunction, such as erectile dysfunction as a result of the neurological disruption. I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to discuss I mean, what is Parkinson's? Because there are so many listeners out there probably want to join in the conversation to find out, because they might have relatives who's got Parkinson's and then they know what it is. And then, in fact, when I was in medical school, I was very much fascinated by Parkinson's disease. You know, obviously not as clever as Ian becoming a brain surgeon, and I end up with different brain surgery. Which is down there. Yes. All right, okay. Anyway, coming back to this, in 1990, some of you may recall there was a movie called Awakenings. And then essentially this was based on, I don't remember who was it? Robin Williams, that's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it essentially is a portrayal of Oliver Sacks, right? Which is a memoir of Oliver Sacks, which is this neurosurgeon, neurologist who discovered the use of the L-DOPA for the treatment for Parkinson's, and basically awakening. It's not quite L-DOPA, right? Okay, but anyway, I mean, that I was a medical student then, and I really found this, the fascinations of the brain and how one medication can transform everything. But it was a sad story, because that medication wasn't the solution. It was temporarily relief. That's why it's called the awakening. Mm-hmm. But eventually, many, many people conditions kind of like went back to square one. And then that's why I'm particularly interested in Ian being here to tell us, you know, 1990 was a long time ago. In fact, this was based in 1973's book from Oliver Sacks, all about his memoir about how he treated patients, and then whether we're venturing into the new era of the paradigm shift of deep brain stimulation.
Yeah. Okay. The more reading I've done, deep brain stimulation almost feels like a panacea, I think, a lot of us, because there's so few options when it comes to Parkinson's. A lot of people have high hopes that deep brain stimulation is going to fix everything for you. And that's why we're here to discuss with Dr. Ian Lau as to what extent does deep brain stimulation actually help with Parkinson's, for an example? Is everyone eligible, or is everybody suited for deep brain stimulation?
Well, let's start with Parkinson's first.
Yes. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 0377 109 000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp us on 0162019 000.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, for the benefit of listeners, because we have a lot of people who kind of said, you know, my elderly relatives is a little bit, movement is a little bit characteristic of Parkinsonism. And so can you just, for the benefit of listeners out there, go back to basic and tell us a little bit of what is Parkinson's and what has actually gone wrong in the brain?
Dr. George, thank you for leading on from Oliver Sacks, but actually, his book refers to encephalitis lethargica.
Is that right?
George.
Yeah. but the book, the film was based on his memoir, right? It's like,
But okay. That condition responds to levodopa as well.
And what is that?
We don't really understand.
Sounds like a mouthful, but
but the main thing, as you quite rightly point out, is that when Parkinson's was first described, they felt that it was a neurological condition characterized by movement problems only. But now we know that Parkinson's is more than that. It's a multi-system neurological disease. So it affects more than the nerves. It also affects the bowels, the brain. And there are many, many manifestations. In fact, for Parkinson's disease, you can divide the symptoms into two large groups. The motor symptoms, which are typically slowness, stiffness, a tremor, and instability. Mm. And you have these so-called non-motor symptoms, which can take the form of hallucinations, dementia. The patients may have what we call autonomic symptoms, where their blood pressure falls, their problems with impotence, bowel problems. Mm. And constipation is very, very common in Parkinson's as well.
Yes.
So we know that Parkinson's disease does not only affect the brain, but it also affects the nerves outside the brain itself.
Okay, but the crux of it is that Parkinson's is due to the lack of dopamine in the brain.
Ah, it's actually more complex than that.
Because we used to think it was just dopamine.
Oh, you mean
dopamine.
That has changed?
Yes. So
they haven't updated the literature on Google.
or Wikipedia.
Now, the lack of dopamine is one of the neurotransmitters which are abnormal in Parkinson's disease. But Parkinson's also affects the cholinergic system, which probably accounts for the dementia and hallucinations.
And the constipation ejaculatory dysfunctions or possibly the bladder dysfunction.
And the autonomic symptoms, which Dr. George referred to, also could be due to the cholinergic system, also due to the purinergic system as well, which is another type of neurotransmitter use. Mm-hmm. So Parkinson's disease affects many, many organ systems. And that is possibly why there's no real cure for it, because more than one system is affected.
Okay, that sounds,
what's
very
gone
complex.
Wrong in the brain?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, that's a very, very complicated one. And
which, because if you people just look at Muhammad Ali and then look at, Michael J. Fox, people would just assume that, something actually had traumatized in the brain and then depleted some sort of neurotransmitter and resulted in that. So is that acquired and some sort of congenital form of Parkinson?
Now, you have brought up Muhammad Ali. His is what we call a post-traumatic Parkinson's. And while Michael J. Fox is what we call an idiopathic Parkinson's syndrome. Mm. So the actual mechanism, we are not really quite sure, but it's probably disruption of a common set of nerve cells. But the exact mechanism is still today is unknown. And that's the million-dollar question.
Oh, right, okay.
And it sort of onset from about 55 years and above, am I correct?
Oh, no. We are finding more and more young people with Parkinson's.
No.
So you have the classical Parkinson's, which is from 60 years and above. And then you have a group so-called young onset Parkinson's, which they get symptoms from the age of 40.
Oh, do we know why?
Yeah, exactly. We're worried because we crossed the 40 mark. And then obviously some people begin to get some sort of tremors. Listeners out there probably get concerned. And how do you know, is any triggering factors, anything that can predispose you to the risk of Parkinson?
We know that certain gene groups, patients with certain genetic groups like having the LRRK gene type, they are more likely to get Parkinson's disease. But what actually triggers these mutations is yet unknown.
Yes, yeah, okay. So essentially, despite the trauma-induced, idiopathic or age-related, are the pathway of this pathogenesis, are they essentially the same? Eventually, they will end up with the same group of problems, which is neurologically similar?
So motor or non-motor?
That's right.
Challenges.
Yes, basically, that's the final, that what is what finally happens. But what triggers it off, we don't really know yet.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay.
Based on the work that you do in the UK, what have you found amongst patients with motor disorders? Is there anything in common? Like, is there a common thread that's underlying a lot of the issues when it comes to motor disorders?
Yes, typically the patients, in the most common, the classical form, usually it starts off with a tremor. And the tremor is, there are various kinds of tremors, but the most common form of tremor, you get it when you're trying to do something. That's called an action tremor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the classical tremor of Parkinson's disease is what we call a resting tremor, which they get at rest.
Mm-hmm. Now, so describe it. It's just somebody who's sitting there and they start shaking a little bit.
Yes.
And is this quite pronounced shaking? It's easily recognizable by relatives?
It's usually subtle at first, and the patient usually says that they have a slight shake in their hand when they're not doing anything, but over time it gets more and more pronounced.
Mm.
And usually it's the spouse which notices that the husband or the wife will start to slow down.
Most people will assume that the husband's nervous of the wife.
That happens all throughout her life,
that's right.
Not just at some stage.
Oh, okay,
George.
See, she admits that, men tend to get a little bit tremors. And
I'm just watching you.
That is true. In general, men do not look after their health as well as women.
Yes.
So they tend to leave the symptoms until late.
Mm.
So in my clinic, we tend to see women who present much earlier than men.
Oh.
And if the men come in, it's usually because their wives bring them to hospital for a checkup.
Right. And what can you do in the early stages? Is early intervention key?
That, again, is a part of another trial, which the results are not quite clear yet. But the in a very, very early, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to ensure that this is Parkinson's disease.
So make the diagnosis.
That's true. There are a variety of neurological disorders which mimic Parkinson's disease, but they are not actually the same.
Such as thyroid condition can cause shakiness and that sort of thing. So how do you make that diagnosis?
It's multifactorial. So you must have a, in the UK, all patients with suspected Parkinson's disease should be referred to a movement disorder specialist.
Wow. Do we have that in Malaysia? Do you know whether we have movement disorder specialists?
I'm sure there are, but I can't really tell you.
Okay, right.
So these patients are, let's say a GP, a general practitioner, sees a patient with suspected Parkinson's disease, then they'll refer them to a movement disorder specialist and they'll be seen at the clinics. And the movement disorder specialist then will take a detailed history and examination, which will raise the possibility of Parkinson's disease. And if the clinical symptom complex is very typical, then they can say with great probability that patient has Parkinson's. But if they are not sure, then they do what is called a DET scan, which is a form of a brain scan showing uptake of radioactive material in the brains.
Right. And specifically in substantia nigra or something. It's like, this is trying a long time ago when I learned about the real brain.
It's really in the basal ganglia.
In the basal ganglia.
Yeah, which is just above the substantia nigra.
Okay, right.
It's part of the brain.
That's right.
Okay, that's all I needed to
know. Okay. So is it like definitive when somebody actually get this scan, and then if the scan shows something, it's either positive or negative, there's no gray area?
I'm afraid it's not as simple as that.
All right, okay.
So as in all neurological conditions, the diagnosis is made on the basis of probability. So if you have a patient which fits closest to what we know as Parkinson's disease, then they are labeled as having idiopathic Parkinson's disease. But if not, if they have patients where their blood pressure falls when they stand up or they get very early hallucinations, then it could be something which appears to be Parkinson's disease but it's not Parkinson's disease.
So
in
would
which
you
case,
say
the
then,
treatment would be different.
Would you say then that it's misdiagnosed a lot then?
Yes, it is. And that's why in the UK, they say that all the diagnosis has to really be the recommendation
done by
a specialist. Is to go through the movement disorder specialist.
I see.
All right. So it's because if, let's say, it doesn't go through a movement disorder specialist, then we are over-diagnosing it.
You may be underdiagnosing.
Or underdiagnosing, Okay,
that's a tricky one, isn't it? We're discussing Parkinson's or movement disorders. Dr. Ian Lau, a consultant neurosurgeon in the studio with us, he practices in the NHS. He's down for Chinese New Year and joined by Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist. It's a Friday. We will come back and discuss deep brain stimulation. We haven't quite come to that yet. There's a lot to actually discuss on that front. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 0377 109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 0162019000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. It's a Friday and doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist.
And it's sunny.
It is sunny indeed. Joined by Dr. Ian Lau, consultant neurosurgeon. We're discussing movement disorders, and in a short while we'll come into the topic of deep brain stimulation, which seems to be something...
possibly the way forward.
Yeah, it could be. It's very much a breakthrough, actually. The literature I was reading, it's a little backdated in that it's still being done on animals, but obviously we have moved way forward. Yes,
we need to update the information.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have a question here via WhatsApp. I'm listening to the show on deep brain stimulation. Speaking of Parkinson's, is it possible to be diagnosed for Parkinson's by one neurologist and not Parkinson's-related tremors? Because this has happened to my dad recently. This is exactly what you were talking about just before the
break. Yes, yeah.
So the misdiagnosis, is that possible, and does that happen a lot?
It is possible. And as I said, that the diagnosis is based on the probability of the condition being so. So in the UK, sometimes, 2.3% of patients with Parkinson's disease actually have essential tremor.
Right.
Which is a completely different condition.
Essential tremor is just basically non-pathological tremor.
It's non-pathological, yes.
All right, okay.
So
these patients, but they manifest in time. So if you have a tremor, like in this case, in the phone-in case there, then sometimes it takes several years
to manifest itself.
Yes.
I mean, I'm playing a devil's advocate here, right? Because at the end of the day, judging from the movie that I watched, Awakening.
And while you're on that, before you go on, there is somebody has written in to say the male actor in The Awakening was Robert De Niro, not Robin Williams.
No, it's not true. I am very certain it's Robin Williams.
He happened to watch it and he was deeply touched.
No, I'm sorry.
I didn't watch it.
Did you watch it? This is a long time ago. Come on, we were born in
the 60s. How do you mistake Robert De Niro?
No, this is not Robin De Niro. Is it for that listeners out there? I am certain. This is Robin Williams, right? So, you know, Dr. Ian agrees with me. So we've got two against it.
Robin Williams.
It's Robin Williams.
Okay,
I think he won an Oscar for that. Come on, there's a kid. Anyway, what am I going to say? According to that movie, right, okay, it was the medicine that actually transformed the pathology of these patients. So the tremors disappears and everything like that. Essentially, until today, it is still the treatment modality, which is medicine, isn't it?
Yes.
L-DOPA, which is a medicine.
Yes, but we have other forms as well. So levodopa is still the gold standard treatment for Parkinson's disease, but there are other groups of drugs such as the DOPA agonists, pramipexole, which is one of them.
Yeah.
And then you have the catecholamine oxidase inhibitors.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're a neurosurgeon because majority of these are treated by neurologists. We're going to lead on to your input as a surgeon. But the thing is that if we don't really know or for certain whether this is a Parkinson's disease or not, can we not do a trial of treatment? Just give levodopa. If it works, then this is Parkinson. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Does that make sense?
These drugs have side effects as well. And you are right. In cases where there's some ambiguity, then some neurologists do give them a trial. But if a patient responds to levodopa, that does not necessarily mean that they have Parkinson's disease.
But
they may have a levodopa responsive neurological condition.
All right, this is getting some complexity of this neurology.
Very much.
Yeah, that reminded me of why I stick to what I do.
The brain is intriguing. It's a very, it's an amazing organ.
Well, that's why you need a brain surgeon who's clever enough to deal with this.
And just to let you know, both of you right, it was Robert De Niro and Robin Williams both acting.
Robert De Niro was the patient. Robin Williams was the physician.
Everyone was right. In the end. Okay, we have LTY on the line. You have a question?
LTY, Kong Hei Fa Choi.
Good afternoon, Mira.
Good afternoon.
Hello there.
Good afternoon, Dr. Keith.
Dr. Ian Lau.
I see. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay. I'm only 74 years old. 74.
But 74
no
young.
Indication of any Parkinson or dementia, right? My question is this: can smoking is one of the cause of Parkinson, all right? And second question, can excessive drinking cause Parkinson? Now, my third question is this. Can we take some steps to prevent Parkinson? Are there anything you can do, for instance, Tai Chi or exercise or anything that involve our movement of body? All right, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, LTY.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Okay. Smoking.
Yeah, whatever you say, just don't encourage him.
Yes, because LTY defends smoking all the time.
That's right, so. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Well, at the present moment, there's no
specific link
between drinking and alcohol and the onset of Parkinson's.
Right. So is there anything that he can do to prevent him from getting this? And like, qigong and acupuncture or some herbs?
That's the big thing that pharmaceutical companies are looking out for. There's no, again, we do not understand the pathology of Parkinson's disease.
If you don't know the cause, how are you going
to...
Okay.
But I mean, it's difficult to answer LTY's question because, although there's no link, but it is not healthy, obviously, because there are other neurological conditions can closely be linked with alcohol and then also, smoking. So LTY, stop smoking.
Yes. okay, so deep brain stimulation. It's described to be an extreme intervention. Would you agree with me, Dr. Ian?
It is a surgical procedure, but I would say that the risk of doing this procedure is actually a probably less. The risk of you dying from this procedure is probably less than you crossing the road.
Really?
You should ask Mira, so what do you how do you define extreme?
Yes. Isn't it major brain surgery?
It's a brain operation.
It is a brain operation, but to tell you the truth, deep brain stimulation is making two holes in the skull, putting two wires in and attaching it to battery.
How big are the holes?
Deep in the brain.
Yes.
Electrodes deep in the brain.
Yes.
That sounds scary.
The electrodes have a diameter of 1.2 millimeters.
Okay.
And the whole procedure is well, it's a very careful procedure. So, I've done more than 150 of these procedures and have not had any strokes or deaths.
Okay.
In fact, the quoted risk of death from deep brain stimulation is probably less than 1 in 100.
Okay, let's take a step back.
Okay. What is it? What are you actually doing?
I mean, it's like, you know, who are the people who needs it and what is it? I mean, presumably these are the people who had medical treatment and failed medical treatment, you know, or not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you get referred these patients from neurologists, and how do you decide who is suitable and how do you do this procedure?
Right. The criteria for doing deep brain stimulation depends on several things. The first is you need to be sure of diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So if the diagnosis is not confirmed and you do deep brain stimulation, it's bound to fail. So that's the number one thing. So you need to be referred to someone who can make a definite diagnosis of Parkinson's disease.
Who is a movement disorder specialist?
Preferably experienced movement
that's
disorder
very interesting.
Specialist.
We need to know whether we have any of these people in the country, isn't it, George? Mm. Okay.
Yeah. And then the second thing is that there are certain things we look out for. One is that the patient must still be responsive to levodopa. Now, deep brain stimulation involves in the insertion of a wire in the brain. We are going to pass an electrical current into this wire here, which will create a localized electrical field. And the electrical field will affect the function of groups of neurons within the brain itself. So the main thing, the key word is it affects a group of neurons. Now, if you have advanced Parkinson's disease, you lose these neurons, and hence electrical field has nothing to work on.
Right.
So if the cells are depleted of these neurotransmitters, there's no point doing it.
Exactly. Okay. So Parkinson's disease, deep brain stimulation is not a treatment for very advanced Parkinson's disease because you do not have enough neurons for it to act on.
Mm.
And we have found that the results are better in patients where the disease is actually quite early on. And this has been proven in a big trial called the Early Stim, which has shown that patients with early onset Parkinson's disease, they actually respond better. And in our own series in Romford, we have found that patients who are less than 50 years old, when we do this procedure, they do significantly better than those above the age of 65.
Okay. So it's like putting in a pacemaker?
It is. It's a pacemaker of the brain.
So it's got a battery and everything in it.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, are the wires kind of like integrated to your skull and then are they attached to some like external device that's constantly stimulating it?
Yes, yeah. So the operation involves making two holes about the size of a 5-cent coin, really, in your skull. And through this, we'll put a small wire into a target deep in your brain itself. Now, the target depends on what you have. If you have Parkinson's disease, where the major symptom is slowness and stiffness, we tend to go for a target called the subthalamic nucleus. If your main problem is tremor, but not so much stiffness and slowness, then you could go for a different target, such as in the thalamus, or the target which we favor called the posterior subthalamic area. And that's extremely good for tremor, but not so good for the stiffness and slowness.
Mm-hmm.
This wire is then passed underneath the skin, down the neck, and it's attached to a battery, which is then placed just beneath your collarbone, usually on the left side.
Right.
And so this is your pacemaker.
Right.
It's just beneath the skin of your collarbone,
yes,
is what you're
yeah.
saying. So the 5-cent coin, it heals. Sorry, I'm just trying to...
Mira's jaws is on the floor.
It's your skull. You're making a hole in your skull.
That's right. Yes. Surely there are repercussions.
Yes, but the brain is surprising. Is surprising. It tells you that you have pain elsewhere, but you can burn and poke it and pull it, and it doesn't feel anything.
Mm.
So the way we do deep brain stimulation in Romford is that it's in three stages. The first part of the patient is asleep, and then we make the holes, and we find a target, and then we wake the patient up on the table itself. And then we pass a very fine microelectrode into the brain itself. Now, the microelectrode measures brain activity, and it converts it into a graphical as well as an audiological signal. So you can actually hear and see which part of the brain the wire goes into. So, and each part of the brain gives a different sound. So it's like listening to different languages. You go and you can plot your way down towards the target itself.
Right.
Oh, so that gives you accurate GPS towards the targeted area.
The GPS is from this MRI scan. So there are several technical things there, but in some places they place a target just on the MRI scan. We do that as well, but we like to be absolutely sure. So we do what is called microelectrode recording. So the first thing we do is we bring the patient, we put the patient to sleep, and then we put a frame on your head, which is attached to the skull.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is all done with the patient asleep. Then we do an MRI scan of the brain, and the MRI scan will then show us the target, which is the subthalamic area. We then wake the patient up, and if we place them on the table. Now, while you're awake, we inject the scalp with some local anesthetic, and then we drill a small hole in the brain, in the skull itself. This is not painful; it's just very, very noisy. So the patient will often tell you that it's very noisy, but they don't feel any pain.
Right.
Once the brain is exposed, we put a microelectrode, 3 microelectrodes actually in the brain, and this will allow me to find out where I am. So the scan will tell me this is a subthalamic area, but the microelectrode recordings will confirm that I'm in the right spot.
Where does the patient have to be awake?
Well, that comes to the next phase.
Because when you're not awake, your brain is sleeping.
Oh.
Well, you can do microelectrode recording with the patient asleep as well.
Yep.
But the anesthetic tends to damp down the tracing, so you get a flat trace.
Cannot be too deep, right? Yeah. Presumably.
I see.
Now is this and at this stage here we do our third check. So we check with a high resolution MRI scan. We do our microelectrode recordings. And finally, we check to see that the patient responds to stimulation, because this is the be and end all of stimulation. So if you're in the right spot, so the patient, as you know, we stop the medications the day before surgery. So on the day of surgery, they're stiff, they're slow, they're shaking.
Mm.
But if the electrode is in the right spot itself, as it goes in, you'll find that the shakes will start to slow down and then they'll stop. And they're very stiff. But suddenly, when you pass electrical current through, the stiffness will disappear, just like a knife through hot butter.
So,
really.
So it's like almost immediate.
Yes, yeah. And if you get that, you know you're in the right spot. So regardless, you know you're in the right spot, because that is what you're going for.
Okay.
So that's why you need the patient awake, because if they're asleep, you can't check.
You can't really check the risk outcome.
So point number one, you need to be diagnosed correctly.
Yes.
And two, you need to be to ensure that your neurotransmitters
is still, are still producing the neurotransmitters.
So those are the two criteria.
Oh, no, there's more.
So now it's getting interesting.
The criteria are that the patient must have a proper diagnosis. The second one, they must have what we call levodopa responsiveness. So they must be able to react to levodopa.
Sure.
And you do a test called a levodopa challenge test. And they must have a minimum of 40% improvement. So you stop their levodopa, they are all stiff and slow. And then after a period of time, you give them levodopa and then they become loose.
Right.
And then their improvement must be at least 40%. The third thing is that we do a high-resolution scan of the brain, an MRI scan,
mm-hmm.
so we can see the target. So if the target doesn't exist, it means it's not suitable for surgery.
Right. Okay.
And the other thing, of course, is you may find that there are more things in the brain. So there may be other conditions mimicking Parkinson's disease. So in which case, a deep brain stimulation will not work.
Right.
And the fifth thing is that the patient must have tried normal medications and it has failed to adequately control their symptoms.
Right.
Now, I choose my words carefully, so it's failed to adequately control.
Because it's contradicting what you said earlier on, because you don't want the patients to be completely non-responsive to to treatment anymore. So you want some degree of failure, but not complete failure.
Mm. So usually the patient will say that, symptoms are still being controlled, but not as well as before, and you're requiring bigger and bigger doses, or you're getting side effects from medication.
Okay.
So that's a time when you know that it's time to intervene. And the final one is that, the patient has to be motivated. They must understand that this is not a cure. And what we are doing is you're opening a window for them, but the disease will eventually progress. They will slow down again. The window will close.
Mm-hmm.
But this may be 10 years later.
Can you redo the electrodes, as in go in again and
turn
know.
Out the volume?
Yes, we can do that. But as I said earlier, deep brain stimulation depends on the availability of neurons. If you don't have enough neurons, it won't work. So as the disease progresses, you lose the neurons. So even if the electrodes are in a correct position, if you have nothing to work on, it can't control your symptoms.
So given all those criteria, what is the percentage of patients who would be eligible for deep brain stimulation?
In my clinic, only 10% of patients that I see are eligible for deep brain stimulation.
So basically, you can safely say that on 1 in 10 bog-standard Parkinson sufferers
yes.
will be suitable for this?
Yes.
Okay.
The vast majority are managed with drugs.
Okay, all right then. That's a very small percentage actually. So you really need to go through that criteria before opting for, because otherwise it's probably not going to work for you. Okay, we'll come back. We're discussing Parkinson's movement disorders and deep brain stimulation. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Dr. Ian Lau, consultant neurosurgeon, in the studio with us. If you have a question, this is your chance. Give us a call, 0377-109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp us on 016-201-9000. We'll continue this discussion after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodhi. If you have just joined us, well, with us, Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Dr. Ian Lau, a consultant neurosurgeon, we're discussing deep brain stimulation for movement disorders. Of course, the most common one being Parkinson's disease, which is what we're focusing on now. I have a question for you, Dr. Ian. How do you manage expectations post-surgery?
Oh, we manage them before surgery.
Okay.
So we screen patients very rigorously. And as I said, those are the criteria. They have to have a definite diagnosis of Parkinson's. The patient must be fit enough for surgery. They must have levodopa responsiveness. The MRI scan of the brain must show no other pathology, and the target must be easily seen. What I forgot to mention is that all our patients actually are seen by the neuropsychologist before surgery. Because as I mentioned earlier, Parkinson's disease may manifest with psychiatric problems or mental problems. So if you do deep brain stimulation in such cases, they often do very, very poorly.
Okay. So they need to be psychologically in place. Okay.
And they must be fit enough for surgery as well.
Sure. Does it take a long time to recover from surgery like this?
Well, typically what happens in Romford is that I bring the patients in on the day of surgery. So usually I operate on a Friday. So on a Thursday, I will ask patients to wash their hair, empty their bowels, stop taking any medication from 11 p.m. the night before surgery. And they come to hospital on the day of surgery itself at 7 a.m.
And if then they got beds.
There's always bed because I bring them in on the day of surgery.
Right.
And then at 8:30, we bring them to the operating suite. They'll go to sleep. And then we'll put the stereotactic frame onto the skull. We'll do the MRI scan. And after the scanning, they'll go back to theatre around 10 a.m. We wake them up and we start the operation. Now, the operation, everything should be over by around 2 p.m. We bring them down for another scan of the brain again to confirm that the electrodes are in the correct position.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get electrodes in, the patient often finds that actually they're quite loose. So they're quite happy because they are all stiff, but suddenly the presence of the wire itself makes them loose.
It must be liberating.
Yes, they are. But they are quite tired by this stage here. And then once the MRI scan confirms that electrodes are correctly placed and there's no stroke or no bleeding, we put them back to sleep again. And then we will then tunnel the electrodes underneath the skin and put a pacemaker just underneath the collarbone and close it up.
Okay.
They spend a night in hospital. And by the next morning, which is on Saturday, I usually see them. And they're usually having a cup of tea and walking around.
Wow.
I switch them on, and then they're home by lunchtime.
Okay.
The stitches are all dissolvable, and I'll bring them back in about 6 weeks to make sure everything's fine. And then at that stage there, I will give them their own personal programmer, which is about the size of a mobile phone, so the patients can actually change the settings themselves.
So they can just tune it up or tune
it down.
That's
true.
Okay.
How do you do that?
It's like really like a mobile phone. So there are buttons to increase the...
Yeah, some apps just like got to push it up or push it down.
Like a remote control.
That's right.
That's true. Yeah.
All right.
Oh,
Okay.
Wow. And so in terms of device management, is there programming involved? Do you need to charge these units? You know?
Yes, there are two types of batteries, rechargeable and non-rechargeable. For Parkinson's disease, we tend to put non-rechargeable batteries, which will last about 4 to 5 years. So in these cases, they come back for the next at 6 months or 12-month intervals for us to check. And then they might come back sooner for us to program the machine. And if everything is stable, we usually see them just once a year. Mm. And when the battery is about to run out, the personal programmer usually will feature an icon of a doctor that says, time to have your battery changed. And then they'll call us. And then we bring them in as a day case. They're awake. We put some local anesthetic in their chest. We take the battery out, put a new one in, close them back, home in 30 minutes.
Okay. Mm. And when you travel, what happens?
Ah. You set off the alarms.
No.
That's the old system. So Dr. George is correct that the old systems used to set up alarms. But with the new neurostimulators, they really do not set up any alarms at all. We had one patient who previously couldn't go to Harrods in London because every time he went through the security gates, he would set it off. But
that
only
probably
Harrods,
is protected for his wallet.
But the new ones, there are no problems at all.
Yeah. I mean, Ian, you mentioned that you've done 150 of these, right? Okay. What is your sort of recorded success rate, and how long do you follow up these patients for?
We are the newest unit in London offering this service, so we have been doing this for the last 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
So my oldest patient is 9 years since I implanted it. He was in London when I first operated on him. He's now moved up further north. But he was well enough to be involved in the construction of the Olympic Stadium at Stratford.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, so out of 150 of them, obviously you follow up quite a large chunk of them.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, when you tell your patient that this is not a cure,
yes.
You know, how sustained are we talking about such intervention?
So this patient, it's coming up to 10 years.
Yeah, but on average,
yeah, so yeah,
what sort of like success we're looking
at? What's going to happen to him after this?
Now, at 10 years, you start to slow down. Mm. So the patients will find that they are not as perky as they were 9 years ago. And then they'll find that they're a bit slower. But because this is a programmable device, you can actually change the settings. So if they're slower, they can actually increase the stimulations. Actually, they become a bit loose again.
Okay. Mm.
But so beyond 10 years... Beyond 10 years, then... The patients will get other symptoms which are called non-motor manifestations. They can become demented, they have low blood pressure, and all, which is unrelated to stimulation, but it's due to the progression of the disease itself.
Okay, so you're only controlling one aspect of
helping to manage.
We have James on the line. You have a question, James.
Hi, James. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Dr. Yen.
Hello there.
How can one avoid this Parkinson's disease?
Okay. Is there any way to avoid Parkinson's
James.
Disease? Well, I guess don't be Muhammad Ali is one of them. Right?
I'm afraid there's no real way to avoid Parkinson's disease because we don't really know what causes it. Now, Parkinson's disease, you mentioned Parkinson's disease, it's a very specific condition. There are conditions which can lead to Parkinson's-like symptoms like head injuries, like Dr. George mentioned. But Parkinson's disease itself is probably a genetic condition.
Mm. Really? Okay. Mm. Yeah. Mm. We had a neurogeneticist in the studio. We have recorded that show. But keep your eyes on the ground because we're coming up with a Health and Living Live 2017, which is our event in April. It's April 8th. Make that date with us because we will be discussing Alzheimer's, dementia and Parkinson's. Mm. And we have a neurogeneticist who will come in and talk about genes and Parkinson's. I think they have done some research here in University of Malaya. Mm. So that could be something we could discuss. So do you see this being...
paradigm shift
that
will change...
Yes, and also it probably can stimulate other centres of the brain to focus on other neurological conditions as well.
Yes, actually, in my unit, we tend to treat more tremor than Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
That's because the National Tremor Foundation of the UK is based in my hospital.
There's a National Tremor Foundation?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, out of the tremors, like you mentioned, essential tremor, Parkinson's, I mean, motor neuron disease, does it cause tremor? And then any other neurological conditions that you look after in the in the association?
No, this is... specifically for tremor itself, and so we the majority of tremor patients that we treat are actually have essential tremor followed by Parkinson's related tremor.
Mm.
So we are a bit unusual because you are quite right. Most units treat Parkinson's disease.
That's right.
But ours is we do mainly tremor followed by Parkinson's disease and then dystonia.
Okay.
Are you excited about the application of deep brain stimulation?
Of course, because
otherwise you won't be.
I mean, you know, just going forward, where do you see it
In 10 years?
You know, that 10% is just in my mind.
That's
it's
right.
Only 10% of
But that is for Parkinson's
disease.
Now, you must realize that the number of patients out there with essential tremor is probably 3 to 20 times more than for Parkinson's disease. And tremor is a hidden disease because a lot of people have a bit of shake. They say, oh, it's nothing to worry about. But it does. It affects you a lot. A lot of my patients actually are too embarrassed to go out. They can't feed themselves. They have need someone to help them. And we actually did a study which has shown that up to a third of the patients, the quality of life or the carers actually worsen because of tremor.
Do we know what causes essential tremors?
Again, it's one of the neurodegenerative conditions which you don't really understand.
Okay. I mean, how many proportion of your 150 patients were genuine Parkinson's condition and how many were essential tremors?
About 50% is tremor and 40% is Parkinson's.
Right, okay. I mean, which group actually benefited more from the deep brain stimulation?
For tremor, it's remarkable. Tremor is in front of you, it just stops. So that you have a patient who can't feed or feed himself, dress himself, and then the next day they are having a cup of tea.
Yeah. I mean, early on you mentioned that, you know, you have to be extremely precise in your diagnosis, but yet you have one group of patients who are, you know, essential tremor. Is that you can't really pinpoint to what is the pathology? How do you overcome that?
Now, that's why the DBS is used for various neurologic conditions. What I mentioned earlier was really pertaining only to Parkinson's disease. Now, for essential tremor, well, tremor in general, there seems to be a common pathway which goes up and down the brain stem. And so previously people used to target the thalamus. We are going down further. We are targeting an area in the midbrain called the posterior subthalamic area, which seems to be where it's like a highway where everything converges together.
Mm.
And regardless of the type of tremor you have, this seems if you block something there, it slows down the tremor.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Because, you know, there are others, epilepsy, Tourette syndrome, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Would they be applicable in the future?
Yeah.
Those will be kind of avenue of potential treatment modalities, you know?
In fact, it's been explored now. Psychosurgery has been used in a few centres, especially in the Scandinavian area.
Yeah, because psychosurgery, you know, coming back, you know, it's gone through a whole cycle because these were sort of like, in the 19th century or 20th century kind of like time that we're thinking about psychosurgery. You're clearly very passionate about this. You've been involved in this work for the last 9 years. You're you know, probably the world-leading specialist in this area. It's difficult to put a price to anything, but Malaysian being Malaysian, we need to know the cost of this. I mean, under NHS system, from the impression you give out, it's like it's extremely stringent in selection criteria, lots of monitoring, lots of counselling, lots of device support and that sort of thing. Can you put a price to this, you know, of how much will individual patient cost and any potential of this being brought to Malaysia?
In the UK, it costs about £30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about a third of the price because of the stimulator itself. And at the present moment, there are three main companies who make it. But I believe that China and India are also producing models which will definitely drive down the cost as well.
Okay, all right. So it's got to do with all of that.
We
will have Dr. Lim Chin Yang, who is, I think, the guru in Malaysia when it comes to this. We'll catch up with him during the health event and find out more about that.
Might grab you to come back again.
Yes, absolutely.
Might grab you to come back permanently.
Yes.
Surely the Yisang will entice you to come back.
It has been a pleasure having you on, and thank you for, you know, coming in during the Chinese New Year break. All the best when you go back. Your message, would you have a message for everyone?
Basically, deep brain stimulation is a possibility. Right.
And that can change a life, you know, the life, the kind of quality of life for many patients who suffers from tremor and also Parkinson's disease.
And for other conditions, we haven't really mentioned the use of deep brain stimulation for pain and for epilepsy as well, which is also very, very effective. Yeah.
Okay, all right. So it's already being used.
Yes,
all right.
I mean, that's obviously very exciting. I mean, for me, initially, I kept thinking that, you know, L-DOPA obviously is something that it's a bygone era, but obviously we're moving into this new kind of paradigm. But now, after listening to you, I really think that the potential is not just with a condition like Parkinson's. It's potentially opened up avenues of treatment and understanding of brain physiology, really, isn't it?
That's true.
Movement disorders.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist, and Dr. Ian Lau, consultant neurosurgeon, speaking to us about deep brain stimulation for movement disorders on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.